And good afternoon, and welcome to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink, who was early, and the early Valletta Lil, who was late, and Laurent Landis, who's not here because it's his anniversary, it's my anniversary, it's everybody's anniversary. Our guest today is Valletta Lil. She is chair-elect for the Center for Public Policy Priorities. Chair-elect for the Center for Public Policy Priorities. She's the former executive director of the Arts District and actually helped build herself the Winspear Opera House. She was out there in a hard hat building it. And most of you know her. She's a former city council chick.
For four terms.
She was the council broad over in District 14. Welcome, Valletta. It's always a pleasure to have you. I don't have to do any work ahead of time because I know we're just going to chat. You know, some shows we really, like last week, I had to read a book.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. It wasn't a hard book to read. It was a good book, actually. But I did have to read. Today it was like, oh, Valletta, I don't even need to send her the address. Because she's been here before at the new studio. Yeah.
Dangers of autopilot.
So you were on the city council for four terms. Something odd happened yesterday. Yesterday was the runoff for three different races.
Six, seven, and eight.
Districts six, seven, and eight, right? I thought you were saying for three races. No, six, seven, eight. what happened?
Three incumbents lost their elections.
That never happened before.
Yeah. The only time is the case of Scott Griggs beating Dave Newman.
That was District 3, and Ed Oakley, also same district throughout Mark Houseright back in the 90s. And that was District 3.
And then when District 3 moved to District 1 with the redistricting,
with some redistricting.
Scott Griggs beat Delia Hasso, who was a sitting council member.
But that was two incumbents who were pitted against each other, so that almost doesn't count, kind
of. Well, in two of those cases, you had the redrawing of the district lines. This is a pure incumbent gets beat, rather than pitting incumbents against one.
So who lost? Monica Alonso, who was mayor pro tem.
Mm-hmm. And the deputy mayor pro tem. Eric Wilson.
Right.
And
Tiffany Young.
Okay, so it's two seats in South Dallas, one in West Dallas. Who won in West Dallas?
Omar Narvaez.
And Omar has been on our show. Omar works for Lambda Legal and...
Very well-respected activist in the LGBT community for many, many years. And will continue to be. He's not going to stop being gay, I'm sure.
So he won't stop being gay for being
gay. No, that's what I heard.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was it with Eric and Tiffany, though? Why do you think they lost their elections?
I think in Tiffany's case, it was pretty hands down the constituent contact. I mean, there was a lot of widespread complaints that she was not responsive.
I think to some degree that was both six and seven. It was a lack, at least a perceived lack of contact with the constituency. And in the case of eight and Eric Wilson, it's interesting because in two races this election cycle, you had prior incumbents beating current incumbents.
Right, because even though we have term limits, it's not that you can only serve four terms. You can only serve four terms in
four
a row.
Four consecutive terms. And then you can sit out. And you can come back. And
We have Sandy Grayson up in North Dallas, who's in the middle of her second four-term.
Exactly.
I don't know what 12 is going to do after she terms out.
Because nobody wants to run.
No, she never has an opponent at all. Her website's like from 2003 or something.
I think she had, when she came back, after sitting out, I think she ran. There was some Tea Party insurgency up there trying to defeat her. Sandy Grayson is a very independent candidate and a very, very independent council member. And so I think her independence played well with her constituents.
She calls a spade a shovel.
You know, she will do what she thinks is right for her constituency. And sometimes she will be in certain camps, and another time she will be in a different camp. And there are times when she will be out there on her own.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say constituent services and that the three who lost didn't have good connection with their voters.
Let me say, I haven't heard as much about that regarding Eric Wilson.
I haven't either.
I think that was perhaps, and I'm not as familiar with the politics of that district, a more beloved incumbent versus one that they liked.
Tunnell.
Right.
Tunnell Atkins, who was mayor pro tem or deputy mayor pro tem?
I don't remember. I think he'd been both.
And when it came to negotiating equal rights for police officers on the police and fire pension board, he stood up for the LGBT community. I have to give him props. He was one of the times that they did not pass it. He was in tears and went up to the police officers personally to apologize that he couldn't push it through. He was just great on our issues.
But I think in 6 and 7, a reoccurring theme that I would hear out in the community was, I haven't seen her. She's not standing up for my issues. And that was kind of a reoccurring thing. I think that Omar worked really hard, mm-hmm. and that plays a big role in winning an election.
And he had an enormous, I mean, I spent the day working his campaign yesterday or some of the afternoon, and he had an enormous
coalition of
volunteers of every stripe. I mean, they were everywhere.
And sometimes in a runoff, like especially in the Fair Park area election, Tiffany's election, it might also have been who got out the vote.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's part of working hard, is to get out that vote. Sometimes, in the case of Tiffany, she was ahead.
She was.
When she came out of the regular election cycle, and then in a runoff, she loses.
But one of the things that they say is, if an incumbent is in a runoff, that incumbent has gotten about as many votes as he or she's going to get.
Right.
And if there are multiple other candidates, well, you might have voted for one of them, but you're not going to vote for the incumbent. You're going to vote for the person who came in second. I'm sure Omar got most of the support that didn't go to...
That did not go to Monica.
To Monica Alonso. When you say connection to their voters, you have a big mouth. I know that everybody heard you in your district. You got around. What are some of the things
I just said evangelist.
She has used the term zealot and evangelist to refer to me.
What are some of the things that a council person should or even can do to connect with voters? What types of things do they
show up? That's really the most important thing. Show up at events. Show up when there's a problem. Show up to try to be in front of a problem. In the case of West Dallas, they were in a position where it's gentrifying at a very rapid rate. And so she really needed to be in front of that problem in the discussion. Then you had a case of people being literally kicked out of their homes that they were renting, and questioning where they would go to find comparable rents. And it appears, as best I can tell, Omar was in front of that and meeting with both the development community and the constituency. And you need to bring everybody to the table for problem solving. And it appears that she was absent in those discussions.
And then a whole concrete plant.
The whole concrete plant issue, and that was a case of the concrete plant was going to be moved to another location based on the fact of the rapidly redeveloping area that is around the Margaret Hunt Hill Bridge. And then it was moved close to a school, which caused grave concerns among the parents in that area and the members of the community.
But the thing is, the kids who go to the school, they don't vote.
You will find that children don't always get represented, whether it's at city, state, or federal politics.
So true.
Right, right.
They don't always have a voice. Mm-hmm. And so somebody needs to be their voice.
Right. That cement plant, it's still there with these big, horrible bins right outside the window of some of these $2,000 or $3,000 a month apartments. Is that going away? Who knows?
Yeah.
I don't know, it could mm-hmm. at some point. You certainly see that with, let's say, storage facilities. They're not a good land use. Sometimes they're there temporarily. A lot of times you see concrete plants being temporary, what they call temporary batching plants.
That one's been there for years.
But this is not an instance of a temporary facility.
And storage facilities, actually in Oaklawn, they're necessary with all of the thousands of new apartments that have opened that are so tiny, you have to have a place for your stuff. Where our studio was, they've been building this multi-level storage facility. You know how our floors were marble?
Uh-huh.
This place seems like it's about on the same level as our old studio. It's the fanciest storage facility I've ever seen.
Have you seen the one downtown? It's brick.
Uh-huh.
It's a brick facade with a portico chair, which is the equivalent of driving up to have the valet let you out.
On the other side of that storage facility, there's one of these Soviet-style apartment blocks, one of these hideous things that where they all look alike. Then next to that, there's another storage facility. How many storage facilities can we...
Well, clearly they need to tear one of those down and put it in a CVS.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. That's
but
what
if
I
that
think
storage it, facility stays long enough and it looks really nice, mm-hmm. well, you know, I may have to go in and try to preserve it.
Yeah. And it lasts long, many years?
You will.
As long as it makes it 50 years, it may see me down there.
Well, this one is being,
for it.
This one seems like it's being built pretty permanently. Not like most of them are being built.
Most of them look pretty temporary, but as I said, for instance, the one downtown, and they have a giant sign that you can see as you're departing Woodall. But typically, the use of brick on a facade is not something you see with a storage facility. Mm-hmm. So
It's usually aluminum.
It's usually a very temporary,
corrugated,
easy to tear down facility. So... But you know, back to the election, it's really about, are you communicating with your constituency on a regular basis about their issues? Mm-hmm. And in a world where communication is extremely fast, it's on Twitter, it's on Instagram, it's on Facebook, it's everywhere, you have to be even closer, I think, to your constituency mm-hmm. in many cases in that way, or at least showing up to all the town hall meetings, the dedications, to hear the problems from your constituency. Quite frankly, I used to drive around my district probably. At least one Friday a month I would take to drive as many streets as possible to see, you know, everything from whether a stop sign was torn, was knocked down.
Lights out.
And report those because people want to know. And then if it gets brought up in a town hall, you can say, you know, I know Mrs. Blair has moved. I saw that the house was torn down. Mm-hmm. I saw the new building. And people feel a greater comfort level with you as their representative if they think that you know something mm-hmm. about them and their problems.
So my council member's normal response to me, David, no. That's not the best answer for most people.
Well, I honestly don't know
at least
how
you got to communicate your issue. You may not get the answer you want to hear, but you got to communicate your issue.
And I really don't know how you guys did it, especially when you had like no salary. Now people have salary, at least.
$50 per official meeting. It was about $3,000.
And then you get penalized if you miss one without notice or something, you know.
Back in those days, we actually set that policy that you get penalized. Back in those days, you didn't, but I can't say that people miss their meetings. We felt once you had a true salary that there needed to be other rules that went along with that salary,
right,
and missing your time. Back when I first started, it was $50 per official meeting. So official meeting was only your agenda days and your briefing days and your committee days. It wasn't going out and doing a town hall meeting or anything like that. That wasn't a quote-unquote official meeting.
See, I don't know how council members make it today. I mean, there would be time, probably days on end, where you don't even get to City Hall because you have neighborhood association meetings, you know, dedications, things being opened, kids celebrating kids and their achievements and, checking out a new construction. And I mean, you're just all over your district. And like, I know some council members, they literally have a solid day booked. They can barely drive from one thing to the next thing, and that's not just Monday through Friday. They have a Saturday. They got a march and a parade, and then they've got to, be somewhere, across their district.
Well, Lee Kleiman has an answer for that. He doesn't drive. He takes his bike.
Yeah, there you go.
His district is up here. He bikes down to City Hall very often. So, you're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink. Laurent will be back with us next week or the week after. He told us we weren't listening. And our guest is Valletta Lill. She is the
you
new...
You will fail at your public service duty then if you were not listening.
Yeah, and people have suggested I run, and I said, you've got to be kidding. Valletta Lill is the chair-elect of the Center for Public Policy Priorities. She'll tell us something about what
that means,
what that even means, and what she's going to be doing and how she'll be interfering in our lives now.
And I listen.
We'll be back
weekly. I hope that you will, too.
And this is Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with late Patty Fink, and our guest is former city council person Valletta Lill. She's the new chair-elect for the Center for Public Policy Priorities. What is that?
It frequently gets referenced as a center-left, some people say think tank, policy policy institute is what we are. We employ about 20 people who are policy geeks. And we work on either helping create policy for Texans that improve their lives or fighting bad policies that are attempted to be passed. It's kind of in three areas, health and wellness. So everything from food insecurity to accessing health care right now, the affordable care, things like, can you get Medicaid if you need it? Can you get SNAP, food stamps, if you need it? Then the other place is economic opportunity. Can you get the education you want and need from everything from pre-K through college? And savings accounts for kids and those sorts of things. And then finally, investing in Texas. And this is a really narrow niche. We try to ensure that the Texas budget is a fair budget. And
oh, you haven't met the legislature.
We have. And we have policy wonks who are, on the ground fighting some of the policies that are attempting to be passed right now. Senate Bill 2, which is, one is the budget.
Mm-hmm.
It's got its number based on priority. One is the budget. Two, Senate Bill 2 is an attempt to reduce the taxing authority of local jurisdictions, where they'd be schools, cities, community college districts, hospital districts. And without going too deeply into it, basically, the law says that you can't increase people's taxes over a certain amount. They can't be, actually, it's 8% per annum. And
which actually is a lot.
8% is a lot. And if you go over 8%, citizens have a right to trigger a rollback. Mm-hmm. To trigger a rollback election.
Yeah, something's got to give.
Something's got to give.
And it's not that 8% is a lot the first year, but it's a lot the 10th time in a row that it's gone up 8%.
Well, you can't do more than, I think it's 10% per year over three years. But remember, the 8% isn't just the tax rate that a city has. It's the overall taxable value.
Oh, okay, so it does take that into account.
It takes that into account.
Okay.
So it's not just the tax rate of a city. The city may never change their tax rate, what you're paying per 100 mil, but it may, as the tax base grows, they're going to have to reduce if it goes over the 8%. So right now, what the legislature is doing, basically, is they keep cutting taxes. They want to cut the franchise tax. They want to cut property tax. They want to cut other kinds of taxes. And when they do that, they're simply pushing that down to cities and to school districts. Or they're simply not paying for something. School is the perfect example.
You have this thing you want to educate kids.
Hey, we have a thing that we want to educate kids. We want to create an educated workforce, which creates middle-income Texans. And
what a novel idea.
What a novel idea. Mm-hmm. It's about taxation, fairness, and those kinds of things. Right now, they keep cutting the amount they allow for schools and giving back to the school districts, and thus the school districts have to increase their property. Well,
that was one of Bob Strauss's, or Robert Strauss.
Joe Strauss
is the Speaker of the House. That was one of his priorities, to reduce school finance.
Finance reform was a priority for the Speaker. It was not a priority for the Lieutenant Governor and the Governor.
Well, no, because he had to do the important things, because it didn't matter what went on in the classrooms. It mattered what went on in the bathrooms.
Still, that's his obsession. It's the special obsession.
And the Supreme Court of Texas has said your school finance is not unconstitutional, but it's bad in every other way.
Mm-hmm.
They use terms like ossified and
ossified,
you know,
wow,
outdated, all of these things, unfair, but it's not unconstitutional. But what the state continues to do is to cut its total budget, thus pushing down to counties and cities what they will need to charge to provide you the exact same services. Mm-hmm. So if you like your police service, if you like water, trash collection, you know, your libraries, your parks, your arts facilities.
If you think when you call 911, somebody should answer the phone.
Yeah. Answer the phone and then show up after that.
Oh, they showed up once I got through.
Exactly.
So, because we've heard of more instances of people who've died as a result.
And great article in the Morning News today, Tristan Hallman, Terry Langford doing an article specific to that issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Channel 11 did a good story on 911s in surrounding areas. Plano is having trouble hiring 911 operators. Several of the other suburbs are too. This is one of the things that I was saying. This can't just be a Dallas problem.
No.
We're not the only ones with, as T-Mobile was saying, old equipment. We're not the only ones using the system that we were using to get the calls to the right person.
Right.
We're not the only ones using that software. Why are we the ones having this problem?
And then you add on top of that, for instance, in Plano, where you have a very educated workforce mm-hmm. and a very low unemployment rate, then who wants to come and work mm-hmm. for, you know, it's not great pay.
Right.
There are other opportunities right. for that workforce to go someplace else.
Part of the problem, of course, we found is just plain understaffing. The night Brian died because we could not get through to 911, there were supposed to be 22 operators on
exactly.
duty. There were 11.
Oh, wow.
So
wow.
And you see that a lot through
mm-hmm.
Texas, throughout Texas. It's the same reason we don't have enough CPS workers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's not enough money.
You had some statistics about CPS.
CPS. We increased the budget.
CPS is Child Protective Services, which is a disaster right now. I mean, kids are dying in the system.
They're sleeping in CPS offices.
Yeah.
With kids.
At least they're safe. Some kids are either
fewer,
not being
fewer
checked,
visits
checked on.
To foster homes or to the to their homes. CPS workers are making less pay. There are fewer of them. And this year, the state is increasing the budget for CPS, but they're increasing it by 17% over 2 years, over the biennium. And indeed, if they increased it by 100%, we would only be average among the states.
That's just so pathetic.
Well, Texas
Beyond
doesn't like
pathetic.
To be average with anything.
Well, we compete with Mississippi for everything. Just
right.
About.
We're 47th in the country in terms of what the state spends on its residents. And then if you look at the feds giving you less money and the cities being unable to tax to deliver services, then we're going to lose services basically at every level, impacting every person.
Wouldn't this be considered in some realms to be sort of unfunded mandates?
These are all unfunded mandates. And, you know, our state government hates the federal government providing unfunded mandates.
Right.
But they are more than happy to reach in and seize.
Well, the sanctuary bill that passed, that's
bill.
An unfunded mandate when it comes right down to it, because
exactly.
it's telling the police departments, the local police departments, local sheriff's departments, what they have to do, which is federal work. And they're not being paid for this extra work that they're expected to do, and they're not being paid to hire extra officers, which will be necessary when
and
they're arresting more people.
And they're not being paid to hold prisoners for longer periods of time.
And that's expensive to do.
That's extremely expensive. So at every turn, they're also considering more bills in this special session, which will limit cities' ability to do everything from zoning to we just had an incident where all the trees were cut along, I think, in the area of Forest Lane, which isn't far from here. And the state wants to come back and limit cities' abilities to tell developers what they do with property, even though we all enjoy the benefits of trees and, you know, historic buildings or buildings that aren't too tall or those kinds of things. So they want to come in and tell cities what to do at almost every level, whether it was the fracking bill, if you remember that.
Right.
Was a session ago, and Denton had passed its own ordinance to say there will be no fracking in the city of Denton. And the state said, oh, no, you cannot decide for yourself. We'll decide for you.
This is all daddy state stuff to me.
This is very much daddy
state. This is daddy state. You know, telling women
what
they can and cannot do with their bodies. Pat, you know.
What I don't understand about the zoning thing, though, that makes no sense. Every city in the state except for Houston has zoning.
And they tried to make this annexations bill that they looked at this last session apply only to Houston, and then they threw up their arms about that, you know, so that the reform could happen, so that there'd be adequate infrastructure if they annex any sort of land or smaller cities or in the suburbs. And it, you know, it was just a fiasco on the House floor, the whole discussion of it. But what really gets me is they'll, you know, we had our, if we look at Dallas's issues, we had for a while, let's get the police to handle the stray dog issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, that's really not their job, and that's not really how they're trained to deal with dogs. That we have people who are, but they're not the ones enlisted to handle the stray dog problem. And then we had, you know, the police were encountering people with mental health issues, and people died as a result, you know, because they would come to the door to answer a 911 call, and somebody would be sort of out of control in their moment, and they get dead. They're dead at the end, you know, because the police shot them. And so they said, well, we shouldn't expect our police department to handle these mental health issues. So let's put together a mental health kind of SWAT team to kind of do that. Okay, so we have sort of a solution for that. And then we lose 5 officers in a shooting. And we say, you know, the police, this is what they need to deal with. This is the kind of stuff they need to do. Not stray dogs, not mental health. And what does the state want us to do? They want to ask papers, please, when they pull people over and right. then hold them. And then they want them to police bathrooms. And to me, you know, we've gone through all of these kind of community conversations about what is the role of the police. And Chief Brown, you know, said it eloquently many times that, you know, the police are here to police, not to chase stray dogs and, you know, that sort of thing. And they're not trained in all the mental health ins and outs. And so that's being handled differently. You know, it's like, when are we going to wake up and be adults here, you know, and not have our police? Because we're just going to have more issues arise if they're expected to do everything and ridiculous things. I mean, how are they going to police the bathroom bill? And how are they going to, you know, to really manage all of this stuff? There's not been one federal request from ICE that has not been honored in the state.
Yeah.
Not one.
The sheriff will tell you emphatically, we don't have anything that's a sanctuary city in Texas.
There's no. It's a made up
construct.
Exactly. Just like the whole bathroom myth that some cisgender male is going to pose as a trans woman in order to get into a bathroom to assault a woman or a girl, and then expect legal protection from a local non-discrimination ordinance to commit a crime in a bathroom. And it's so insane, and it's never happened. Not once in Dallas, not once in the state of Texas, not once in 50 states in this
country.
And
the thing is, it hasn't happened that cisgender men are dressing up as transgender women either.
Yeah.
So that part of it is not happening either.
The whole thing is ludicrous. And so this is the mentality of our state legislature. And then you let them manage money? Oh, my God. You know, that's why we have CPS kids mm-hmm. sleeping in CPS offices and not having homes and not being checked on for a year and, you know. Oh.
You know, this was a week where you had the world over sort of change related to politics, and Theresa May ran into her own set of issues. But also, Governor Brownback in Kansas ran into his own Republican legislature, said, you cannot continue to cut taxes and expect that you will deliver services. And they literally raised the taxes on him.
And he tried that whole austerity thing, and it didn't work.
The austerity thing did not work, and they were not able to fund their schools at...
No austerity program, the way it's done, works. Greece is a mess because of an austerity right. program. I mean, around the world, it doesn't work. It's just...
And then you
doesn't.
Compound it with the Affordable Care Act was structured in a way that you know, young people were expected to participate, and there was this tax in it, but there was also this idea of state marketplace exchanges. The states would set up their own exchanges. But what did a lot of states, a couple of dozen states, do, including Texas? No, we're not going to participate. Right. So they refused to take federal money by refusing to set up an exchange and expand Medicaid. They refused.
You know the number one loser dollars. Because of that? Parkland Hospital.
Parkland Hospital.
Yes.
Parkland is going to have a certain budget and take care of a certain number of people, because in Dallas we've believed since the late 1800s that if you're sick you have a right to go to the hospital. Wow.
Can't be turned away because you don't
right.
have the money.
Right. In Dallas we have had that policy and we have funded it. I saw John Wiley Price arguing with somebody over some AIDS funding. It's called ADEP funding, which pays for drugs for people, HIV drugs for people who can't afford it. And his question was, if the federal government cuts this program, because there was a threat several years ago of cutting the program, if the federal government cuts this program, how much is it going to cost us?
Right.
Because his assumption was, because we're going to pay for it. We're not going to just let people die. It went, there were about 10 people from Parkland there. It went all the way down to the 10th one who said, I know what you're talking about. I can find out. I can't find out exactly because it depends on the negotiated rate of the drugs, but I can certainly let you know. You know,
we're
going to
be stuck with it.
We are going to be stuck with it because we believe in funding that. So who lost? Dallas County taxpayers. Because we had to pay it. We need to take a break. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. Our guest today is Valletta Lill. She is the new chair-elect for the Center for Public Policy Priorities. Yeah, I want to see what some of these policies that she's going to come up with are going to be. They're not going to be happy. We'll be back with more right after this.
Rawlins Gellin, and I'm listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3. And darn glad to be doing it.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink, and we're talking to Valletta Lill. Valletta, I just wanted to completely change the topic, or kind of half change the topic, to preservation, because you've been one of the big preservationists in the city.
Preservation evangelist.
Or zealot, whichever you prefer.
Yes. I prefer zealot.
And as I said on Facebook, I said, you know, sometimes preservation is your religion. And you
it is
evangelize about your core values of
do.
Your religion.
Now, when you were on the council, you had an official position and could take stands on this building in my district is not going to be torn down.
Right.
Have you ever had an official position with any of the preservation organizations or anything? Or
I did sit on the board of advisors for the National Trust for Historic Preservation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What are some of the issues that are going on right now? I know Fair Park is one of them, and the Hall of State, which has been flooding.
Fair Park has been an issue for... I actually started, interestingly enough, in 1992, the city of Dallas held an election that they were looking at doing a half-cent sales tax to be dedicated to Fair Park, and it was to go for, I don't remember, it was a year or 2 years. And all that money was then to go to repair buildings in Fair Park. And overwhelm, and to assist with the neighborhood surrounding Fair Park. Well, overwhelmingly, the voters voted against that. And so the decision was to, okay, do public-private funding to try to rescue buildings, if you will. Because remember, many of these buildings were built as temporary.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of them, and certainly not the Hall of State. In the 1930s, opening in 1936. And so we went to public-private partnerships, and the Women's Museum was opened with largely private funds, a little bit of public funds. But there is always a tension between the various institutions at Fair Park. Specifically, you like to go enjoy your corny dogs every year at the State Fair of Texas, which is a good economic generator for the city. And quite frankly, Fair Park provides a beautiful backdrop.
It's a wonderful tradition.
It's a great tradition, and really the State Fair of Texas is more successful than a lot of state fairs. At the same time, it creates challenges for the institutions that are at Fair Park, whether you're a museum or a radio station or whatever you are, or even doing special events. It creates this I can't get, you know, my users can't get to the building over time. And so that has stirred up an issue of who should really be managing Fair Park. And in 2003, when I was on the council, we came up with a master plan that said, you really need to go out and get a third party manager to do. It needs an umbrella management so that the state fair is on equal footing with all the other institutions, and that you can program do other programming.
And that's kind of the way the zoo is.
That's kind of the way the zoo is.
You know, I was always against these until I saw how successful the zoo has become. The zoo is doing fabulously
and
well.
And the Arboretum is another example
mm-hmm.
of one.
Yep.
The Arboretum is another example of it, and quite frankly.
And what is the arrangement? It's a public-private...
It's a public-private partnership. Usually the city kicks in X amount of dollars. It's a specific amount of money every year. And then the management on site is a third party, private party,
mm-hmm.
a nonprofit. It's always a nonprofit to manage the day-to-day operations of the facilities, and you know, a little bit of money perhaps for maintenance of buildings or mm-hmm. that sort of thing. The APAC gets $2.5 million a year to do maintenance on the building and the operations, and then everything above that is the responsibility of somebody else. The zoo, I think, is $10 million a year, and then everything else is somebody else's problem.
I mean, zoo is getting it just in increased attendance.
They get it in increased
attendance. Is skyrocketing.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was the day the rhinoceroses went on exhibit, biggest day they've ever had. And that was passing a day just a few months before with the new elephants. They've been doing fabulously well.
The giraffes and the elephants, mm-hmm. everything is doing well.
So I was kind of against this whole scheme with Fair Park, and that's how I saw it, until I realized, but the zoo is doing so well, maybe this is a good idea.
Well, the city has a policy that says if any city money goes into something, the city needs to own it. And as a result, we own a lot of buildings.
Mm-hmm.
That have either been gifted to us, the Majestic Theater, mm-hmm. interestingly enough, on a 6-5 vote by the Dallas City Council, they almost didn't take the gift of the Majestic mm-hmm. Theater.
Wow.
From the Hoblet sales.
I'm so glad they did.
I'm so glad mm-hmm. they did. But anything, even though 90% of the money may have been private money going into it, the city owns it because there's some city mm-hmm. money, capital money in it. So we've long had these relationships, mm-hmm. if you will. The thing with Fair Park is, you know, my biggest concern at the moment is the maintenance of the buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And it needs a lot of money to be invested.
The Hall of State, which is, as you're walking into the park from the new DART station, across the fountain, all the way down that fountain, it's that long building. And it has that Diego Rivera mural that is just, it's one of two that he did, the other one's in Rockefeller Center. It has just, it's a repository of Dallas and Texas history. It is one of my favorite places.
It gives me chills every time I walk into that building.
Do you know,
nobody who ever goes into the Grand Hall doesn't take a picture.
Right.
Yes.
Exactly.
Exactly. Because they can't stop themselves.
Here's what I never understand. When I'm giving somebody a tour of the city, the first thing that we do, I mean, depending upon timing, but always included in my tour of the city, I always take people to Fair Park. Always.
Always.
Yeah.
And the Hall of there's never anybody there.
And the Hall of State is just a gem. It is just a gem. There are
so
a lot
here's
of gems
my plan
in the
for
city
it.
Too. But Hall of State is a really special one. And
here's
I think
my plan for it. We tear it down and put up a CVS. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to get in my plug, and that is you in November. You will be voting on a bond program, and right now the council, in its whatever iteration it is, with different folks on there, is making decisions about what's on that bond program. You need to make sure that those things that you do treasure and do need to be repaired, the Hall of State, the Kalita Humphreys Theater,
mm-hmm.
the Majestic, the African American Museum,
mm-hmm.
all of these buildings are on there and getting the repairs that need to be done. And in many cases, the Meyerson is they have a leaking roof, just like the whole of state does. Hmm. They have flooding coming in, et cetera. And we're talking about one of the at least top 10, not top 5 concert halls in the world.
Right.
And do we really need to be walking around puddles of water to do so? Because it's an image that we have to the world, and it's great concert halls. So
it's more than just an image. That we use it.
We use it. We love it. It's our soul. Mm-hmm. You know, these cultural facilities.
If Meyerson wasn't there, I don't think the Windspear or the Wiley or City Performance Hall or even the high school that's right there,
Booker T.
Well, Booker T was there
before.
Not the size that it is now.
And not the, certainly, of the stature.
Not the stature, because those kids get to use all these performance halls.
Exactly.
But I forgot, kids, they don't vote.
But the city does need to repair and properly maintain the buildings that it owns and that you've already paid for. And the Hall Estate is one of those, and we're looking for $8 million on the bond program. But there are other buildings. But Fair Park, quite frankly, decisions need to be made about who manages Fair Park.
Mm-hmm.
Because somebody has to be the alpha dog.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody needs to be the alpha dog to make decisions about how that park gets used on a regular basis. It needs to be more of a park and less of a parking lot.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, there needs to be more green space and fewer parking lots, and you can build garages for that. That's fine.
And you can take DART there now.
You can take DART.
I have gone to the state fair every year.
Right in the front gate on Perry.
I've taken it. I've gone to the fair every year. So many years I skipped the fair because I don't feel like fighting with parking.
And now you get that. They've even made the station, the DART station, it's Art Deco, like right in line with everything else. And it's a beautiful, wonderful experience. And especially when you ride the train and they add extra trains to move
people to
and from the fair. Yeah. Yep. And, you know, you get the people from out of town, from out of state, and they just gasp when we round that corner and that gate comes up. And they're just, the excitement and the it's so impressive. It really is. And I'm like, I buy into that too. I'm like, yes.
So beautiful at night if you go out there.
Oh. They do the Chinese lantern exhibit. They do lots of things at night that are just gorgeous and must be done at night. And it's a beautiful place to go.
It's and when you think of the craftsmanship in those buildings and the young artist in many cases who did a lot of that work. The Ali Tennant who did the Tejas Warrior was not that old.
Right.
The young woman who did the cowboy that's in the Dealey Library, she was in her 20s when she did this work that it has lived on far beyond her.
Okay, here's the gay story with Hall of State. 1979, it was June 1979, the first Razzle Dazzle Dallas took place in the Hall of State.
Oh, really?
And Eartha Kitt was appearing at Dallas Summer Musicals in the show Timbuktu. She heard, or her chorus boys heard, that there was a big party, a big gay party going on across the way. So they brought her. She performed. And so did they. So did all the chorus boys. The thing that, I don't know, you might remember this, Valletta, for years after that, if you walked into the Hall of State, you left with glitter all over your shoes. There was so much glitter at the first Razzle Dallas that it took years before it was gone.
And there might still be some in there, because, again, it needs maintenance.
You know, in the basement. There's probably still some glitter.
In the basement. If you see any, though, that's where it's from, 1979. But that was the beginning of, you know, a tradition that funded all of the AIDS organizations for a number of years.
Was that the first one?
That was the first Razzle Dazzle in 1979. And
who organized that?
Oh, there was a committee.
Yeah. Again,
you know Dallas. I think Bill Nelson, Terry Thibodeau, Don Mason.
Don's still around.
Yeah.
I mean, I can talk to some of the Dallas Way folks, but these are stories, or, you know, oral histories that we need to get down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And well, you were, so. We saw you this past week at City Hall, you know, expressing your zealotry, evangelizing in the council briefing for the bond package to make sure that the Hall Estate gets the money it needs. You know, but we were all there, too, for the celebration of Pride because it was declared, you know, Pride Month in the city of Dallas.
Or you could have been there for SB4.
You could have been there for SB4. Lots of reasons. But if you go to City Hall during the month of June, folks, take time and go. It's just a partial exhibit, but and there'll be more in the years ahead because it's pretty white right now. But there's an exhibit all in City Hall's lobby.
In the lobby. Yeah. You go right through security, and it's right there.
And it's just amazing stuff. Just really amazing stuff.
Yeah, she's saying it's amazing stuff. There's a picture of Patty there. So I said, when she's walking through, I said, Patty, come here. You're an artifact.
Yeah.
So I took a number of those pictures,
you
though.
You did, in fact.
Yeah.
And Brian Price, who's head of the new City of Dallas LGBT Employees Association, which I'm so happy is it's new, it's growing. He's going to be on the show in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And so we'll get to learn more about that. But what a celebration. The big pride flag in the lobby hanging down from you know, it's what a joy.
You know, we only have a couple of minutes left, and we can't go without saying this is the anniversary of Pulse.
Yes, tomorrow.
It is.
Which was just devastating. I met a couple of the Pulse survivors. I was down in Orlando for the LGBT Journalists Association meeting. And I met a couple of the survivors. We went to see Pulse. The sign, that iconic sign now, is still lit, but it's lit dimly.
Wow.
In memory. It's become a shrine. The actual building is fenced off, but on the fence all around are big banners and flowers and mobiles, and there's a rock garden with messages that people left on the rocks. Most of them are just hearts, because what can you even say? It is each person, and I said this, I wrote this in Dallas Voice, each person as we stepped off the bus started crying, and I was just watching. As each person stepped off, they started crying. And I stepped off, and I'm in tears, and we were there for 30, 45 minutes, something like that. We were just overwhelmed. There's just no coherent words to describe.
And today, in D.C., there's a march on the Mall. It's the National Equality March. They're marching. You can watch it on C-SPAN. It was going on before I left the house.
Was there a presidential proclamation for it?
There was no presidential proclamation for recognizing Pride. But tonight in Dallas, there will be a candlelight vigil and a march that begins at the Resource Center, the new building at Inwood and Cedar Springs.
5950 Cedar Springs Road.
Right. And we're going to commemorate. Can you believe it's only been a year? It seems like every day is a week these days. Yeah. But it's only been a year. I'm going to be reading the 49 names of those lost, and there'll be a few speakers, and then we're going to march then down to the monument at the at Oaklawn in Cedar Springs. Yeah, because so. it's sort of a big day.
Mm-hmm.
We should not mention that.
And how do we? It's always a struggle on how do we memorialize.
I love the one at the Human Rights Campaign's building, which. You know, I was in that era of, you know, National Board of Governors and stuff with the Human Rights Campaign when we raised the money for the building and installed the building as the home of HRC. There's a beautiful art piece installed on the building itself, which is a kind of a pyramid looking set of streamers that come down. Long streamers in white, one for each person who died, and on the outside of them are the colors. Kind of check out thinking about it, the colors of the rainbow, kind of hugging them.
We are completely out of time. Although the next show might want us to talk for a few minutes while they get here. You are. We want to thank CVS Preservationist and Dallas Trump organizer Valletta Lill for being our guest today. That's what we talked about, right? Yeah. And we'll be back next week with more Lambda Weekly.
Thanks, Valletta.
Thank you.